Well, folks, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Dan Renshaw. Welcome, Dan.
Well, thank you, Mike.
Today, I understand we're going to pick up a few threads, particularly around the Snowbird Mine.
We've been spending a lot of time over in the Archangel Valley.
Okay.
It's a beautiful spot. As you drive in the Archangel Road, the mountain on your left is considered to be Marmot Mountain on its west extension. I don't know that it has a different name on the east, but it bends to the north. Makes a big scimitar type thing from looking down from the air. And as you go around that at the bottom, there's a spot where the valley really opens up. You can see way up Archangel Valley. You can see into Reed Creek Valley. You can see the expanse of the Little Susitna Valley. It's really a very interesting drive up the Archangel Road.
Right. I've done that. And I've been amazed. One, that the road still seems to be drivable. It doesn't get a lot of tender, loving care.
Well, boy, did you notice recently this last summer?
No, I admit I wasn't up there this last summer. Talk to me about that.
Oh, you're going to be amazed when you go back this spring, because the DOT had it closed. And let me commend DOT every time I get a chance to. They've been awfully good to me.
Okay.
I'm always parked at the end of road maintenance in the winter, and they're awfully kind not to berm me in and so on. And this last summer, you wonder where in the world did these funds come from, but they did an enormous upgrade on a Archangel Road.
Oh.
It looks like it's prepared for pavement.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you'd be amazed.
Did they widened it? Or
widened it quite a bit, in as much they cleaned the ditch out. On the north side.
All
and
right.
Then they cut a lot of brush on the south side.
Very
so
good.
Now when you drive in, you can really see the vistas and so on.
Because that had been growing up, I know.
Yeah.
I know that had happened.
What about
then there are those low spots where there's water in a creek and crossing over down.
Right. That's down in the area where the Mabel Mill site is located, which touches the road, the Archangel Road, on the north side. And there used to be tailing ponds in there, and then the beavers kind of liked that, so they perfected it into beaver ponds. And,
right.
And the beavers decided they'd plug the culverts, and it got to be a real mess. They've done a lot of work on that. All of the road, all the way into the bridge. Now, the bridge over the Archangel was condemned. It should have been condemned a long time ago. It's an old wooden structure, and it was getting really fragile. But they finally condemned it, and then the DOT has put a Bailey Bridge across over the top of it.
Okay.
So you can still drive into the valley beyond. excuse me. But it looks like the intent was not to do any more improvement beyond the Bailey Bridge.
Okay.
So you can still get to the usual parking spot where you would go to Reed Lakes.
Right.
You
right.
can still drive up the wretched condition of the road up to the Fern Mine.
Right.
You can still do those things, but it's almost easier to walk.
Okay. So, but getting to that first part, you say, is considerably improved.
It's just, what word would I use? Significant isn't adequate. It's entirely improved. Happy to see that kind of a thing. And then when they left that project, they went up and started doing a lot of improvement on the Hatcher Pass Road. And you may have seen some of that going on. And,
right. Because that the pavement is fine to Independence Mine. I remember when that went in and everything changed as a result of it. But going over the pass is another story, especially since people come around the curves and invariably tire spin and the washboard effect begins anew.
Yeah, it's dangerous, yeah.
Okay, so back to the past now.
Yeah, we're back. We didn't exactly finish up over in the Archangel Reed Creek area over on the eastern end of the Willow Creek Mining District. So this is, we had mentioned the Snowbird Mine, which was a late development after World War II, and one of these cases where they really didn't have their ore developed sufficiently to justify the mill they built. And when they started doing the mining, extracting the ore, oops, found out they didn't have the ore that they thought they had.
Right.
And the additional exploration work that they did was inadequate to find more. So yeah, they were fighting a lot of problems. The after-war inflation, the static gold price, the inflation not only in items that were needed for mine development, but also especially labor was getting to be very expensive. And the old miners were being lost. You know, hard to replace the old miners. So the end of it all was that that was a failed project. The mill was there for many years. It suffered a lot of damage from snowslides over the years. Finally, somebody went in. The claims had lapsed, and he filed new claims and to take the equipment and took it out, took it to another mine down in southwest Alaska. So there was very little left of the Snowbird Mine. Today, it's hard to find anything left in the brush there on the Reed Lakes Trail. I wanted to mention just briefly, last program, the name Phil Holdsworth came up. Phil's an interesting character out of Alaskan history. He was a mining student. There used to be a lot of School of Mines in the different major universities all over the place, one of them at the University of Washington in Seattle. And Phil was a student there, and he had a summer employment that was multiple years at the Nabesna mine, working for the owner of the Nabesna operation, which is on the north side of the Wrangell St. Elias Park area.
Okay.
The Nabesna mine was not a large mine, but it was quite a rich mine. There were periods when they had some very good ore. And Phil was constantly recommending where to go, what to do to the owner of the mine, and the owner of the mine wouldn't have this kid telling him. I don't know why he employed him to begin with, but he was very reluctant to do anything Phil asked.
Okay.
So Phil, finally, he graduated from the University of Washington as a mining engineer, and he took a job in the Philippines at a mining operation in an area known as Baguio, north of Manila, something that had been there for a long time but had a spurt of activity in the late 30s. So he has kind of a bad timing.
Oh,
Phil,
right.
Phil and his wife Peggy show up at the, I don't know the name of the mine that they went to, but just before the Japanese invaded in World War II.
Okay.
And they were in the Philippine resistance force, hiding in the jungle.
Right.
And doing what they could to try to interrupt the Japanese, were finally caught and endured pretty unspeakable conditions for the remainder of the war. His wife, Peggy, was severely, I guess injured would be the right word.
Okay.
Poor diet, poor everything. Phil survived and was quite healthy, quite a robust individual. But when the war was over and he was repatriated, he came back to Alaska. And he worked for the Independence operation for a while and then worked over at the Snowbird mine for a while. And from there, he went to a lot of prestigious positions, finally in government. When we became a state, Bill Egan wanted him for his commissioner of natural resources and so on.
Oh, okay.
So Phil had a very illustrious career in government then during the formative period of Alaska's history.
It's a very interesting story. That could probably be fleshed out in even more detail, but
it would be a really good novel. Yeah, one of these things that you wouldn't have to embellish it much, I'll tell you, to make a fabulous story out of his life. Yeah.
Right. So now we're going to move on.
We've finished, we've been over in the eastern end most recently. Prior to that, we'd spent quite a bit of time, Mike, over in the Craggy Creek area, Lucky Shot, War Baby, Bullion, those mines, and that's over on the west side of Hatcher's Pass. Now let's kind of come home to the Fishhook Valley, which is in the middle of the mining district, and mainly people recognize the Fishhook Valley as containing the Independence Mine State Historic Park.
Right.
It was my great pleasure, Mike, to sit in on the formation of the park. A fellow by the name of Starkey Wilson had acquired the Independence property, but it was required of him when he acquired the property to sit down with the state and see if there was a way to create a state park. Starkey Wilson, individual out of Dallas, Texas, good old boy, oil man kind of a thing. I met Starkey when he was doing the initial development work on the Beluga coal field. Little known about the Beluga field other than it was a huge resource. And he did a lot of the early day drilling in the area to try to fathom the extent of the deposit. He was working then with the Hunt brothers and can't think of the other guy's name, but anyway, they had a Bass. Mr. Bass is primarily known for the development of Snowbird in Utah, the ski area, and so on. But wealthy people from Dallas, Texas that were into resource development. And I met Starkey there. He had asked me to do a little work for him out on that project many years ago. And then when the Independence became available, I knew of his interest in gold mining. This is back in the 70s now, and asked him to look into the possibility of acquiring the Independence, which was available, the claims. The claims had gone to kind of a bankruptcy procedure in order for the Independence to try to open their mine again after World War II. They sold what were called production certificates to the shareholders. And these were indentures that when they came due, by gosh, the people wanted their money.
Their money, right.
Yeah. And the Independence did operate for a while in the late 40s and even into the early 50s, but they couldn't pay those indentures off. And so finally, this whole thing came crashing down in a court procedure. So the claims were available. So here we are. There's the I can't remember. Johansson was the director of the Division of Parks at the time. He had an underling by the name of Chip Dennerland. So there's four of us in the room. There's Starkey and me and these two state representatives, and we're discussing all of these claims. And Starkey is into this. He wants to create a park. He thinks this is a great idea, but he doesn't want to hurt himself as far as the mineral development potential. So my instructions that I received from Starkey was I was the bad guy, and he was going to be the good guy.
Okay. All right.
So there's three good guys and one bad guy at this meeting, and my job was, Starkey, we can't give him that claim because... And then give the geologic or mining reason why. So this was an all-day procedure with the four of us. But when we were done, that was the creation of the land base for the Independence Mine State Historic Park. Quite interesting.
Oh, and Starkey had access to the mining...
He had actually a window of opportunity for doing underground development using the facilities, what's called a water tunnel at the Independence.
Okay.
In a way, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself because Let's come back to this, Mike, because okay. what I'm wanting to do today is to get more started on, let's say that people listening are familiar with the visitor center at the Independence Mine. Let's say they've just walked out of the visitor center. They're standing outside in that upper parking lot, and the buildings of the Independence are in their view as they look west. Now, as they look west, they're going to see two mountains. One is called Skyscraper Mountain, and it's an abrupt peak. And technically, what you can't see is a ridge that extends to the south and west all the way to Hatcher's Pass. But technically, all of that is called Skyscraper Mountain. It's a ridgeline.
Okay.
Then you see another mountain to your right as you're looking west, and it's a massive mountain. We've been up on top of that before in our discussions, called Granite Mountain.
Right.
Between the two, there's a rock glacier. Used to be a regular glacier. So much rock fell into the ice and mixed in that it became predominantly a mass of rocks that were moving very slowly, and then as the Ice Age left us, why, here's this pile of rocks that looks like a glacier. So it's called a rock glacier. Standing there then and looking up on Skyscraper Mountain, let's go back to 1905. And we look up on that mountain and we see a guy standing on the peak. And this is probably the first non-native to stand on the peak, 1905. And he's looking down, and the dates are a little bit flexible, 05 or 06.
Okay.
It's Robert Hatcher, and we've talked about Mr. Hatcher before. And as he looks down, he sees what is sometimes called a quartz ledge. There's a piece of quartz standing on the mountainside where it shouldn't be. The glaciers surely should have eroded that away, but somehow left this piece of exposed vein. And it's very obvious to him that it's vein material, so it's just a short walk down the mountain on the east side, and he walks up to this, and he can see gold in it, and it's massive. It's just a big piece of quartz. And he understands the strike and dip on it, how it lays in the mountainside. So he stakes some federal mining claims on the area. Now, the federal mining claims, we've talked a little bit about that in the past. By this time, 05, 06, we have the organization of a mining district generally in the area.
Okay.
So he can stake these claims under federal rules, and he has a place to record them, two right. steps that are very important to put together. He does this. He names one of the claims Skyscraper, so therefore the name Skyscraper Mountain and so on gets stuck in perpetuity here.
Okay.
Mr. Hatcher is given credit, as we've talked about this before, Mike. I don't want to take anything away from Mr. Hatcher, but it was a serendipitous find. He's a prospector, yeah, but he's just a hiker, really, and stumbles. No, underline. Put all kinds of quotation marks around, stumbles onto this exposure, and he recognizes it as being very significant. So he stakes his claims. At that same general time, we've talked about a family named Barthoff, and the Barthoff family had made the trail in 98. They had been in Dawson for a while. They had actually had a meat market in Dawson. You can see pictures with the sign on the building. But they moved on, and they moved down into Alaska and filtered who knows where in order to get to the Willow Creek Mining District. But they ended up there. And it's a family, a father and several sons, and there may be a few cousins mixed in with all of this, but there's several of them, and they're all experienced in mining. They're out of Colorado.
Okay.
The father's home prior to coming to Alaska was Loveland, Colorado. But the Barthoffs, as a group and also individuals, were doing a lot of prospecting on Granite Mountain. And the first date that's given for a discovery is 1907. Up on the top of Granite Mountain, near the top, there's a vein that the Barthoffs named the Independence Vein. Now, being from Colorado, we've mentioned previously that there was the Arkansas River comes into the Colorado Rockies and had a lot of placer gold in it. As the miners followed that up into the hills, they found what later became known as the Cripple Creek Mining District, which today continues to be a big producer in gold. But a lot of mining claims filed there. A lot of hard rock mining began. The veins are very steep, almost vertical. And a fellow by the name of Stratton was a carpenter living in Colorado Springs down at the base of the mountains mm-hmm. on the east side. And he loved the prospect. So he would spend his off hours and weekends up in the area prospecting. And he makes a startling discovery. And he calls it, he makes his discovery on July 4th, I think it was 1891. And this is late in the mining district. Why this hadn't been found before, who knows? But he stakes just two claims. And because the vein is vertical, he can follow that all the way to the center of the earth, you know, technically.
Sure.
And he begins development on what becomes a spectacular mine. Very, very rich. The vein is big enough to allow him to do some really outstanding development work. He doesn't trust banks.
Okay.
So he starts out small, and he builds this into a huge mine. And it's quite a story. Anyway, this was all current event for the Barthoffs living in Colorado. So when they come to Alaska and they find this small vein on a high mountain, why, gosh, let's call it the Independence, because maybe there'll be some trade-off with using that name. Then in 07, as they continued to explore on Granite Mountain, working their way down the mountain on the north and east side, they find another vein that they call the Granite Mountain Vein. Now things start ratcheting up here a little bit. In 1908, a group buys a lease option from Barthoff's on the Independence and the Granite Mountain veins. There's the mining claims that were staked on those those veins. This group has a representative by the name of Carl, and we've talked about Carl numerous times, C-A-R-L-E. And Carl came into the district representing these investors in 1908. And it might seem a little strange that why did the Barthoffs option that property to somebody else? Why didn't they develop it? And the answer is they had also found the bullion property.
Oh, okay.
And we talked about that. So they were going to concentrate on the bullion, and they would let somebody else play with these claims. So Carl is there for 3 years, from 08 to 11. And Carl brings in, first of all, he shows up and I don't know if he understood what was in front of him as far as what was required, but the road was terrible into the mining district. Hatcher had done some work on building upgrading an Indian trail, and others had worked on trying to improve a better trail, but Carl had some mining equipment, milling equipment, and he needed a wagon to bring stuff in. So Carl does a lot of road work in order to get his wagon load of his first mill into the area. So it's oftentimes called the Carl Wagon Road. today, when you drive the circuitous path from Wasilla to the canyon of the Little Susitna, it's hard to pass anybody because the road wanders so badly.
That's true.
You can thank Carl for that.
Oh, okay.
It's essentially the Carl Wagon Road that you're following. A lot of improvements over the Carl Trail, of course, but
sure.
It's generally the same road. Carl finally gets all of his equipment up to where he wants to be, and he sets up a mill which was composed of a three-stamp mill, and the stamps were 500 pounds each. So this is an awkward... All of this old equipment is just so massive and heavy. All the pieces, you wonder how in the world did they ever get all this in there and up and running, but they did. And a lot of labor required for all of this. But Carl locates his mill exactly where the Independence Mill is today, the remnant of the Independence Mill. Most of it is badly fallen down. And that site is chosen because he has a head of water that he can use. In fact, there's enough head that he actually runs a Pelton wheel for running his equipment. There's a dam at the top of that, some people call it a waterfall that falls down through the Independence camp. It's probably somewhere between that and rapids. But at the very top of it, you can see an old dam structure. And that was Carl's original work. It was upgraded a little bit in years after. But when you see that it was a timber and rock fill structure and then a little bit of miscellaneous whatever to reinforce it, but that was his intake for a pipeline that ran water down to his Pelton wheel. Nothing is left of his mill because that site was completely taken over by the Independence development in the late 30s. But Carl mills there the first year, now 08, when he shows up, he got a lot done considering he had to build a road, he had to bring in the mill and set it up, and he only extracts, according to the records, 87 ounces, which is... You know, he didn't get much milling done, in other words. But he also brings in a lot of cable. So he has cables that are strung on the mountainside all the way down to his mill from the Granite Mountain vein and from the higher Independence vein. It's about 1,200 feet of elevation from the Independence vein down to his mill.
Okay, so I'm picturing this and I'm thinking, so this is the only mill that potentially will serve not only his but other...
Well, it starts that way, Mike, but as time goes on, why, we have a rapid-fire number of developments, and I'm probably running out of time here.
Yeah, you have a minute or two.
A minute or two, so let's at the same time mention a guy by the name of William Martin, Billy Martin. He had quite a reputation when he comes into the mining district, but in 1908, he's with a group of people who... organize a company to buy Hatcher's Discovery up on Skyscraper Mountain. And it's hard to get all of the facts together, but my rendering of Martin's involvement, he's an attorney. And so he's representing these people. He's also involved in the company, but he's also representing them. And he's asking questions like, have any of you ever seen this property you bought, that we've bought? And and it's, well, not exactly. We've got some pieces of rock, you know. Well,
which
how do you
we
know?
Believe came from.
Yeah, yeah. So Mr. Martin is a big, he's very strong on due diligence. So he comes up to take a look to see what they have purchased.
And
he is electrified by what he sees.
And we're going to stop right there because this is what's called a pregnant pause, a moment of anticipation, and we will pick this story up and describe what electrified him in the next session, Dan.
Okay, Mike, we'll look forward to that.
All right. Thank you.